It's the California Wine Country Podcast with Steve Jackson and Dan Berger. We taste, we laugh, we learn.
It is California Wine Country. Dan Berger, my co-host, of course, is here on California Wine Country. And our guest today, the iconic winemaker, Greg LaFollette. Greg, good to see you, man.
Thanks. Good to be here again.
You're hip to Della Tofola, right? Every person that comes in here, I ask them, and they go, oh, when something screws up, we call Della Tofola.
Yep. Well, and they have a lot of really great machinery, too. So
right,
I've used it for many years, that brand, all kinds of machines.
Very cool. Okay, so Dan, I'll start with you. Talk about Greg and all the wine that he's made over so many years.
We could go back and do an hour and a half on just his history, but we're not going to do that because history's history.
Yeah.
Greg's been around for a long, long, long time. He's obviously, you can tell that from the gray beard. No beard.
Yeah. Oh, no, he's clean shaven like me, finally.
Well, the harvest is over, that's why.
Yeah. So
Greg worked with Andre Chelichev, was a star student at UC Davis. He has made wine up and down California's coastline, especially with brands that you are all familiar with. Many, many brands he's worked with. He was at Deloitte for a while as a consultant. He's done the Tandem wines, which were fabulous. But more recently, Greg founded his own winery under his own brand. It has become quite the underground talking point of California wine in the last several, 3 years or so.
About
3 years, these wines are all sold out direct to the consumer. And the reason that they're selling out is that Greg made them. These are just fabulous. It starts with his identifying of great vineyards, and then he's using techniques that are incredibly risky. And I've never tasted a wine that Greg has made that had anything but exactly the precision that he wanted in the wine. Even though there's riskiness in all this, Greg is the master at that. Tell us about these risks that you take.
Thanks for that, Dan. I really appreciate the kind words. Yes, I've been accused of not practicing safe winemaking. And
I like that.
And a lot of it has to do with using wild fermentations, not inoculating, and using things like dairy tanks that are very broad and shallow, which has great surface-to-volume ratio but requires a lot of hard hand work, including hand punch downs and hand shoveling out over your head. I leave wine on the lees a long time. I go to barrel sweet and dirty. As much as I love my wife, she's raised six kids and put up with a winemaker, so no reflection on her. But
six kids,
yeah. Right.
You have a lot of leisure time between the wine and the six kids, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The kids were 17, 18, or 19 years ago on the show here. I think we were interviewed at the old station.
On Humboldt?
Yes, exactly.
Was that with Grady? It wasn't me.
I can't remember.
Steve, I think, probably. Wasn't it?
Steve Garner.
Yeah.
Could have been.
Yeah.
So they still remember that. And they might even be listening right now. I don't know. But so we do a lot of handwork, very old school, old style. And the wine that we're tasting right now, the Alchemista Mayfee Vineyard Chardonnay, is very much reflective of that.
And this is a 2017 that will be released next week?
Yes, we're actually our wine club is getting it right now, and then we'll actually have it for release starting next week.
And Dan, talk about this wine. You're going to lay it down for 100 years, probably.
If I make it that far, this wine will outlive me for sure. Old French Burgundies still are alive. You've got 50-year-old, 40-year-old old French Burgundies. Now, part of the reason for that is they had acidity that was way, way, way more than the wine needed when they were young, so they never got drunk early. People always had problems with the high acids. So Greg specializes in age-worthy Chardonnays because they have this beautiful lemony aftertaste.
Oh,
this
big lemon, time.
After that finish is a classic Burgundian style of flavor. You don't see it very often in California because it is such a risky process to make. And so that's why this wine has got a future ahead of it. I would say minimum 10 years.
Wow.
And then there are a lot of people who would go further.
Yeah, I've been enjoying my 2002s from this vineyard, formerly called the Dunois Vineyard. And my wife and five of her girlfriends, or now couples, get together once a year. And I always bring up some nice older wines. And this year we brought up some 2002 Chardonnay and Pinot, looking great, not even missing a step.
Wow.
But part of that's because it's we're picking at about 10 grams per liter of natural acidity. So high that you have to actually pray that it goes through malolactic in order to do a natural deacidification.
This is a process that most winemakers who are really worried about their marketing departments would never risk, because if you end up with a stuck fermentation, or if your malolactic doesn't go all the way through, you're going to end up with a problem, and that problem is not saleable. Greg never has a problem because he did so much microbiology work at UC Davis, and he knows pretty much what's going to happen with these bugs.
Let me read this. With degrees in plant biology, chemistry, and food science, research and experimentation have always been at the heart of Greg's winemaking. His early experiences include time as the research viticulturist and enologist at Beaulieu. And of course, you mentioned Dan Andre Chelichev. Greg, fill us in on more of your history, how long you've been involved in the wine world, and talk about Andre, because his name comes up all the time.
Oh, as it should.
Yeah.
I was just last weekend in New York. The Robert Parker 40th anniversary Matter of Taste was the New York premiere of Andre, the Voice of Wine, the new film.
It's about a documentary.
About an hour and a half long.
Is it streamable?
I don't think so yet. I think
Okay. Next
year it'll be given a general release, but right now it's going through various premieres.
I've heard his name on this segment for 10 years all the time, and I can't wait to see that documentary.
It's a beautiful, beautiful film and really captures his passion. And I was lucky enough to be asked to be on a panel there last weekend. And we had Ornelia there and the B.B. George Latour Private Reserve winemaker of many years, Joel Aiken, and Rob Davis of Jordan was there. So
but Andre is so iconic.
Yes.
And he did most of his stuff here, right, in this area?
He did, Sonoma and Napa counties.
Yeah.
He's probably best known for his work with Beaulieu Vineyard, but he, after he retired from there, after 30-something, 40 years, something like that, he went on to another career internationally, putting wines all over the world that are now iconic vineyards, such as the Merlot, Ornelia, Washington State.
How old was he when he left for Wine Heaven?
93.
Nice.
Yeah.
I did an article on the ages at which winemakers pass away. And I had 30 people in the article. They were all winemakers, and they all died past the age of 88. And most of them died well into their 90s. And I
drink wine, folks.
I did that as a result of an article that had been written to say that you shouldn't drink wine. I figured that was enough to tell them.
There you go. There you go.
Oh.
Wow. And how old were you when you started in this world?
Oh, gosh.
Not the world, but the wine world.
Three.
Because you were just born in the world. So
yeah.
It would have been whatever. Right.
Well, that was about 34 years ago. So
Dude,
I was close to 30 at the time.
You look good. You're young.
Thank you. I just shaved off my white beard.
That helps, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you get started? I mean, you went to UC Davis. You mentioned, you referred to all that, but get a little deeper.
Okay. Well, I wanted to be a winemaker since I was 17 years old. My parents would come up here to the wine country right before school started, and I'd ride my bicycle from wherever I was working at the time, and and meet them up here. And when I was up here on my own, I'd stop in at tasting rooms. This is the age, I was 17 years old, and
wow.
Back in those days, in the early 70s, nobody really cared about that kind of thing. And
they weren't checking your ID.
Right. And they'd see my bicycle with the sleeping bag and stuff on it, and they'd say, well, where are you going to be staying? And I'd say, oh, I'm going to go up to this park up over here. And they would say, well, we got an extra bedroom, or you can have a hot shower. And I'd sometimes end up spending the night with these people. And,
wow.
And at the age of 17, I was walking through a vineyard with a young guy named John Bueller, who had just planted a young vineyard in the Napa Valley. And he had an infant on a front pack carrying him and a toddler kind of bowling alongside of him. And he was popping grapes into his toddler's mouth and looking at the refractometer. And right then it struck me that wine growing actually grew good people. And that's the moment when I decided I wanted to be a winemaker.
Nice. What a story.
Well, going back to L.A., it's down there, it's like who becomes a winemaker, right? It's not practical. It's like going to rabbinical clown school. No one does it anymore. And
so the phrase rabbinical clown school has never been spoken on this show in 10 years. So, that's cool.
Oh, well, so instead I became a professional bagpiper.
And, yes, I know that. And Kathy earlier said, I wonder if he's bringing his bagpipes. And I said, we can only pray that he won't.
Well, the definition of a gentleman is a man who knows how to play the bagpipes.
But doesn't.
Unless he's asked.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes. So I'm sorry. Keep going.
That's all right. So that ended up not being so practical either. and although I was the ship's piper on the Queen Mary and a few things like that. And,
whoa.
And it was good fun. But after that, I did a short stint in the seminary of the Catholic Church. Of course, six kids later, that didn't take. So I ended up doing the next easiest thing, and I became a physical chemist and did HIV research at UC San Francisco.
Oh, nice. Wow.
But everybody that I worked on there died, and it was really it was very hard. It was back in the very early days when they didn't even really have a name for it.
80s.
Yeah, the early 80s.
Yeah.
And so I got pretty burned out pretty quickly, and I remembered my wonderful thoughts about becoming a winemaker. And I did a lateral transfer from the staff at UC San Francisco to UC Davis, and then did my postgraduate work there on how Burgundian winemaking techniques affect mouthfeel. So I had a short stint as a kind of an academician, including lecturing at the University of Burgundy. Very cheeky for an American to go to Burgundy and lecture to Burgundians about Burgundian winemaking techniques.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
But they did invite me. So so I went, and I haven't looked back ever since.
And you grew up in Southern California?
Well, my dad was in the Air Force, so I was born in Iceland. Most of my elementary years were in Germany.
Wow.
And then junior high and high school in Southern California. So
wow.
I lived in the San Fernando Valley Granada Hills, the Mighty Highlanders. So I was the school bagpiper for that, too.
Of course you were.
Yeah.
Right. So was I.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Oh, where's your overalls?
Yeah. Wow. Do you still – I'm sure you own bagpipes. Do you still play them?
I do, yeah.
Really?
I pipe the first grapes in and the last grapes in and the first press in and the last press in. And
I like that.
Yeah. Now, yeah. When no one's around, I sometimes just play my pipes to the wines because they like the vibrations.
I bet they do.
Yeah.
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 Wow. It is Mr. Greg LaFollette, one of the most iconic winemakers in our area and the world, obviously. Dan Berger is here. More thoughts on Greg, Dan.
Well, one thought that just came to mind was an issue, and I won't go into detail because it might embarrass somebody, but that we were doing a consultation. Well, I was part of it. I was a sensory consult for free. with no charge at all. I don't charge for my advice so that nobody can sue me.
What is a what is a sensory consultant?
Well, basically it was asked to come and evaluate what the consumer might think of these wines and what the if there were any problems that I could see and if there were any solutions.
Wow.
I had previously tasted this one Chardonnay, and there was something wrong with it, and I couldn't tell what it was. So I called Greg, and I said, can you come by? And he said, yeah, when do you want it? And I said, well, I'm here now, and this is the second time I've tried this wine. It's not very good. He said, I'll be by in about 10 minutes. You happen to be right there. He
wow.
walks over. He picks up the glass. And he says, oh, here's your solution. Boom, boom, boom. It was done. The winemaker took his advice. The wine came out fine. And he never charged for that. And I was just blown away that he could just, in one sniff, he could say, here's your answer. It's a talent.
Without even tasting it?
Yeah,
in the mouth,
yeah.
just smelling
yeah.
it?
Well, you can tell a lot by smell, but I think that one I also tasted, too. So.
Well, it wasn't too bad,
yeah,
ultimately.
Yeah, yeah but about 75% of your problems in wine have to do with the aroma.
And really?
If there's a problem with the aroma, oftentimes there's a problem with the taste factor as well.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, not to mention the fact that Greg didn't mess around with the varietals. He makes a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but mainly it's Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and Chardonnay, and that's pretty much it. I mean, you're going to make some Riesling for me someday, but other than that.
Yep. Oh, I'd love to.
Well, we enjoy the interaction because Greg's really – there are not as many people in this world who are winemakers who have as much of an abiding interest in other people's wines. And later tonight, we're going to be tasting some Washington State Cabernet Franc that I got samples of that I just absolutely can't believe I even tasted that was that good, and I wanted Greg to try it. So we're going to do two of those later tonight.
I want to remind everyone that California Wine Country has its own podcast every episode. Any place that offers fine podcasts, you can find it, or you can go to calwinecountry.com, and every episode is there. Make sure that you
subscribe.
I'm getting better on it. Subscribe. It's free. And then it'll show up in your phone or whatever. It is California Wine Country with my co-host Dan Berger. Brought to you by Della Tofola and Bottle Barn. We're going to talk to Barry Herbst, the wine buyer from Bottle Barn, in just a few minutes. This is pretty much his busiest night of the year. They stay open a little later so everyone can get over to Bottle Barn and get their wines and spirits and beers and stuff for Thanksgiving tomorrow. Our guest today is the iconic winemaker Greg LaFollette. And Dan, Kathy asked you a question off air, so
okay. The question was, what about Pinot Meunier and
Meunier?
Meunier.
I've never heard of it.
Meunier. It's an offshoot variety of Pinot Noir. It doesn't often make it into a varietal labeled bottle because it doesn't have an awful lot to it. It doesn't have the substance of a Pinot Noir, but it does have gorgeous fruit. And
I can taste the fruit, but it does seem a little light. Now,
it's a little light.
What year is this, Greg?
It's a 2017 also.
Oh, it is. Okay.
It's very young. It's not really made for aging. You can see from the color. It's sort of pale.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have – now, we're 5 days away from November 15th, which was the official date of release of the Nouveau Beaujolais. In France.
Yeah, that's an
so
annual.
So, Greg, tell us how
deal.
You made this wine.
Pretty similar to the Nouveau Beaujolais. This was all carbonic maceration, 100% whole cluster.
Okay, I'm throwing a geek alert.
So these were berries that were thrown into the tank with no crushing, no pressing, and so that basically this was an anaerobic or without air fermentation. So these berries actually ended up getting about, 3 or 4% alcohol inside each berry before he did any further processing. So you end up with berries that taste like wine. And obviously you can't sell berries that taste like wine, so then he pressed them out. Go tell us the process.
So So, Steve, what we do with this wine is we actually put the fermentation tank in the back of my bullet-riddled pickup truck.
And, oh, come on!
Well, it's different growers in Mendocino County, although it's legal now, so I don't know if that's good. But so we put it in the tank, and we drive it up to the top of Sonoma Mountain, where the Vanderkamp Vineyard is. And this is one of the highest vineyards on Sonoma Mountain. It's right across from the Zen Buddhist Center. We actually pick each cluster and carry it gently while singing and place it gently into the tank, whole cluster.
Are bagpipes involved?
Yes, there are bagpipes involved in that vineyard.
Sure. Yeah.
So, among other things. And then we seal it up and bring it back down, 100% whole cluster. And once a day, we step on the top of it. There's no punch downs, no pump overs, no cap manipulation, because it's all whole cluster. And all we want to do is keep the cap fresh. So we just break the very top berries by treading, kind of stepping on it.
Is this the old barefoot Italy kind of thing?
Yes. Yep.
It is.
Steve, it's 100%. This is the only job six kids would fight to do.
I can imagine.
Growing up.
It's fun. When the fermentation starts, you feel it on the bottom of your feet.
That's exactly right. When you're treading it, you know when it's time to press. When those berries, it feels like you're stepping on bubble wrap, and they start popping. Because each berry is its own fermentation vessel, and it's swelling from the pressure. And so you step on it, and it goes pop, 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 pop. It's time to press.
Oh, my God.
It's fun. I've done it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Barry Herbst is on the line from Bottle Barn, one of our great sponsors here on The Drive in California Wine Country. Barry, I know this is like your most busiest day of the year, pretty much. How you doing?
Good. It's definitely up there in the top four.
Yeah.
It's
so
rocking.
What are you guys doing as far as specials? And just give us the whole thing.
Well, certainly there's a boatload of Sonoma County Pinot Noir out there. That's probably the best seller by far. But a lot of Riesling going out the door today.
Nice.
And Beaujolais from France goes really well with the food.
And as far as the, you know, I'm not a turkey guy. I don't like turkey, man. I'm making Cornish game hens and clams, vongolais, linguine and vongolais with my son tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
But as far as turkey goes, let's all talk about some of the best wines. Let me turn. What are you laughing at, Dan?
Because this fits right into my spiel that I would never waste time with on the air, but I'm going to tell it anyway. So go for it. Okay.
All right.
All right. Oh. If you have a turkey that you dust with sage, which is traditional, the best wine to serve with that is a 30-year-old. Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon, because 30-year-old Napa Valley Cabernet has sage in it. That's one of the elements of old Cabernet. And if you've got a 30-year-old Cabernet, this is the thing to serve with it.
Can you just pour it over the turkey?
You pour it over your mouth.
Yeah, there you go.
Catch any of the
drop. Actually have a couple of those here.
Yeah,
1986 Maya Comus.
Today's Cabernets don't usually have much of that sage character, but the older ones do, and we've got lots and lots of them. And every time we have anything that's got sage in it, we'll pull out an old Cabernet, and it works great.
All right, Barry Herb, our good friend, wine buyer at Bottle Barn. Thanks, buddy. Don't work too hard tonight, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you very much. Same to you all.
Okay, buddy. It is California Wine Country. Our guest today is iconic winemaker Greg La Follette. Let me just talk about Della Tofola for over 60 years. 60, count them. They've been making equipment for the wine, beer, and beverage industry. Greg, again, just give me some of your experience with these folks, because they're amazing.
Well, there probably isn't a winemaker that doesn't have experience with Della Tofola.
Yeah, that's what we've been hearing. Yeah.
They make all kinds of great materials. I don't do a lot of filtration, but I have used the Della Tofola earth filters, diatomaceous earth, and have really appreciated those over the years. They also are making some of the latest filtration systems. They're called cross-flow filters, and so they
which means
it's a tangential flow, so it's actually more gentle than forcing wine through either a membrane or a pad.
Oh, okay.
So it actually is a little bit more gentle on the wine, and that's kind of the new thing that's going on right now. Are these cross flow filters?
A lot of winemakers used to avoid any kind of filtration But you can run into some problems, and some of the equipment that Della Toffola has is so gentle that it really operates the way a traditional filter would, but it doesn't beat up the wine.
Makes sense. All right, very cool. All right, so what is this you guys are tasting?
This is a serious Pinot Noir. So this is a, is this the 16 or 17?
This is the 16 Méfis Pinot. That, okay. We have the Méfis Chardonnay. This is the Pinot Noir.
Well, I thought your 15 was sensational. This one is a little backward considering where it is. It is fabulous wine, but it needs at least two more years.
Yeah, it's pretty big, a big Pinot, especially considering that the alcohol on it is really low on this. The alcohol is 13.5.
That's which, beautiful.
That is low, yeah.
Yeah. Our next year's one, the 17, is only 12.98 alcohol.
Wow.
So.
That's pretty low.
But the low for a Pinot, right?
Well, it's low for almost any red wine in today's world. Back in the 70s, every wine, an alcohol listed at over 13% in the 70s was considered high alcohol. 13.
Wow.
And then most of them were in a 12 to 12 and a half. But now that we've changed the way we grow grapes, everybody's getting higher alcohols. And this wine really has a beautiful structure. The thing about this is that if you were to open this today, if you're not really a Burgundian lover, you'd say, well, it's a beautiful wine, but it just needs food to go with it because of the acidity. The acidity is also your friend when it comes to aging. And this wine needs at least 10 years, and this will be great in 10 years.
Yeah, like I say, I've been drinking my early 2000s from this vineyard.
Right.
And this is a real easy vineyard to pick. For the Pinots, my first pick there is the high 21, 21 Bricks, 21.8, low 22s. And the Chardonnay, you just pick it before it rots all to heck. So it's real easy to pick there.
Acid is your friend.
Yes.
It was mine in college. That's a whole nother story. I don't want to go there. But wow. Well, so about 10 years?
Well, the more you give it in cool storage conditions, if you were to keep this at 70 degrees for 2 years, you'd come back to it in 2 years from now, you'd be disappointed because it's just not the right temperature. It needs to be below around 60. If you can keep it at 60 degrees for 6 to 10 years, you'll notice as it goes along through that 10-year cycle that it doesn't change much. And then you get to 10 and you say, well, wait a minute, do I have two more bottles? Well, let's go another 10 and it'll make it.
Wow.
This is why I encourage my wine club members to buy a case. Not that I want to sell them more wine, which I do, but I think drinking a bottle every so often and letting it go for a few years really shows the site, and this is a great site. It's been called one of the best Pinot sites in the world by Paul Anamosa, who is one of the world's top vineyard soils guys.
Well, just a point of reference, Steve, tomorrow for Thanksgiving, I'm taking a bottle of my son's birth year, a Pinot Noir, which is from Burgundy. We're taking it over to his house, and he was born in 1978. So we're going to have a 78 Burgundy tomorrow at his
house. And it's going to be fine.
Should be. It was in my cellar.
Wow. Wow. Greg, talk about what you're doing now and the website and how to become a member and all that stuff.
Well, our website is www.alchemistacellars.com.
Alchemista.
A-L-Q-U-I-M-I-S-T-A.
Why do you wine people make the names of the wineries so hard for people to remember? I'm just curious.
Well,
I'm sorry.
If you go on our website, you won't even find a physical address. And the place where we are doesn't even have a sign. And you have to know a gate code to get in. So
Alchemista.
We keep it kind of quiet.
Where does the name come from?
The Alchemist. It's kind of a nod to Andre, my old mentor.
Oh, okay.
And I also like Paolo's book, The Alchemist. So, yeah.
Alchemista.
Yes, Alchemista, The Alchemist. And it's the idea is turning something base into precious, something precious. And,
sure.
Yes, or sunlight into wine, so to speak.
Right on.
And I'm doing that, and I'm also working with Ancient Oak, and they were very badly affected by the fires. They lost everything.
Oh.
So they're having to replant vineyards are normally a good fire break, but in this case, their vineyard burned. Only 200 acres in the fires from last year burned.
Yeah, because the vineyards are green. Amazing fire breaks.
Yeah. But in this case, it was the concentrated fire that came down, skipped across Highway 101 and burned into Coffee Park,
right
where I live. And so they're having to replant the whole vineyard that Ken Moholt Siebert's grandfather planted.
Did you lose your home or you made it?
No, my home was fine. One of my son's homes was destroyed. So he lived with us until recently. And we were evacuated for, I don't know, 10, 12 days. But,
jeez.
Yeah. But well, everyone's okay. And I consider myself lucky every day. I've got kind of the best wife in the world and six wonderful kids and now some grandkids. So
beautiful.
And I get to make wine every day. So
it's a cool thing. Dan?
Well, wine like this, we shouldn't emphasize too much the age-worthy potential of it because most people don't want to age anything for very long. And when you buy a bottle of this, the way to get access to all of its fruit flavors is to simply put it in the decanter for about 2 to 4 hours.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because you're talking about laying down for 10 years or such.
Yeah, but most people don't do that.
Julianne
and I do because we understand the mechanics, but very few people want to say, well, look, I'm XYZ age and I'll never see it, blah, blah, blah. So they basically say, well, why would I want to buy this? Because the flavors are all there, ready to be accessed. And the best way to do it is to simply decant the wine into a decanter and trust the winemaker and let the wine sit there without touching it for, 4 hours, would you say? Or in this case, 4 would be probably a minimum, I would think.
Well, yeah, that's one of the great things about wines like these is that I tell my clients that you're saving a lot of money because you're not just buying one bottle of wine. You're buying 3 or 4 over the course of an evening. And the wine is like a kaleidoscope. It changes over the course of an evening.
And it gets better.
Cool.
If it comes from a great vineyard and a great winemaker, you have nothing to lose by opening it up 4 hours ahead and just waiting.
I've asked you this before, Dan, as far as I don't have a decanter at home. I want to get one. I'm going to the dollar store tonight. They must have one.
Probably cost you a dollar.
Thank you.
You'll give me one? All right, thanks, Dan.
Any glass vessel that has been washed out with no soap, just hot water,
okay. And
then dried with a clean towel, and then just put the wine in it. It could be a pitcher. It could be a plastic tub. I don't care. As long as let's not stand on ceremony. The idea is to get some air into the young wine.
Yeah.
You know, if it's an old wine, you don't want to do this. It's tricky because the old wine has already had plenty of oxygen, and if you put that into a decanter and wait for an hour, wine's going to be dead.
Okay.
Older wines can't.
And Greg, as far as decanting, you mm-hmm. agree with, like, say, this for maybe minimum 4 hours?
Well, I would prefer to double decant it and then watch it over an evening. And I've also just poured
what
you another
What is a double decanter?
You decant it into a decanter and then pour it back into the same bottle again.
And oh, really?
And use a funnel because that will actually infuse more air into it as you're doing the second decant. And that gives you an opportunity to smell the wine as it's going back into the bottle. And we've done this several times where people will say, well, gee, this is a better bottle of wine than I had the last month or so. Well, it was double decanted, and it's still in its original bottle.
Well, yep. What does the air do at this point, you know, as opposed to 10 years laying it down?
Well, they both kind of do the same thing. If you have a regular cork in a bottle, you get about 1 milligram per liter per year of oxygen, and it's a nice, slow, passive infusion of oxygen. When it's a young wine, you put a lot of oxygen into it, and it opens the wine up. Allowing it to breathe.
Yeah, and that's what we've always heard. You know,
right. And
this wine needs to breathe.
Right.
Well, so do I.
We all do, right, hopefully. But for all the hardcore chemists out there, you're changing the oxidation reduction potential, the redox potential on it.
And I'm not going to throw a geek alert on that one. I figured that out. We're wrapping up California Wine Country with Dan Berger and the iconic winemaker Greg LaFollette, brought to you by Della Tofla and Bottle Barn. And you can catch it all on a podcast at calwinecountry.com or wherever great podcasts are offered. Okay, we only got about a minute and a half maybe. So
just go ahead. Tell us about this wine. Okay. This is absolutely sensational.
This last wine, Alchemista Hawk's Roost Vineyard Pinot Noir.
What year?
2016.
Wow.
And we'll be releasing the 2017s very soon. But this is from a special clone from a very special grower, Chuck Jones. It's off of Willowside Road, pretty near to the Laguna de Santa Rosa. And it's a Swiss clone called Klebner Mariafeld, which is not a very common clone. It's very thick-skinned, great acidity from this site. It's very Eurocentric.
If you want to put one away for 20 years, this is it.
All right. This is gorgeous. Yeah. And I would normally ask Dan to tell me why I love this wine, but Mike's given me 10 fingers. Now we're down to 3. Greg Follett, great to see you again. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Steve.